So the title of my talk is The Tender Gravity of Kindness, and that line comes from a poem, and I'm going to talk about that poem in the second half of the talk. The first half of the talk, I'm going to talk about another poem. So the poem, the talk is basically a commentary on two poems. So the first one is called Singapore by Mary Oliver. So I'll read it to you, and then I'll talk about it. In Singapore, in the airport, a darkness was ripped from my eyes. In the women's restroom, one compartment stood open. A woman knelt there, washing something in the white bowl. Disgust argued in my stomach, and I felt in my pocket for my ticket. A poem should always have birds in it, kingfishers say, with their bold eyes and gaudy wings. Rivers are pleasant, and of course, trees. A waterfall, or if that's not possible, a fountain rising and falling. A person wants to stand in a happy place in a poem. When the woman turned, I could not answer her face. Her beauty and her embarrassment struggled together, and neither could win. She smiled, and I smiled. What kind of nonsense is this? Everybody needs a job. Yes. A person wants to stand in a happy place in a poem, but first we must watch her as she stares down at her labour, which is dull enough. She is washing the tops of the airport ashtrays, as big as hubcaps, with a blue rag. Her hands turn the metal, scrubbing and rinsing. She does not work slowly nor quickly, like a river. Her dark hair is like the wing of a bird. I don't doubt for a moment that she loves her life, and I want her to rise up from the crust and the slop and fly down to the river. This probably won't happen, but maybe it will. If the world were only pain and logic, who would want it? Of course it isn't. Neither do I mean anything miraculous, but only the light that can shine out of a life. I mean the way she unfolded and refolded the blue cloth. So that's the poem. So did you get what's happening there? She's at the airport waiting for her plane, and she goes into the restroom. Obviously, she's Canadian. American and Canada, they call toilets restrooms. So she goes into the toilet, and she sees in one of the cubicles with the toilet a woman on the floor, on her knees, washing the tops of the airport ashtrays with the water from the toilet bowl. And Mary is disgusted. So that's what the poem is about. So I'm just going to go through it with you. In Singapore, in the airport, a darkness was ripped from my eyes. Isn't that quite an image? It's a very violent image, isn't it? A darkness was ripped from my eyes. Very violent kind of image. What is that darkness? What is the darkness that's ripped from her eyes? I suppose it's self-absorption. There she is, probably a well-off Canadian woman travelling the world in an airport, and she doesn't know that there are women who earn their living doing this kind of thing. So suddenly her own kind of self-absorption is ripped from her eyes, and suddenly she's seeing something for the first time. The metta-bhavana practice that we do allows the darkness of self-absorption to fall from our eyes gradually and non-violently. So we do it again and again and again, and little bit by little bit we open our eyes and see that other people exist as people, not as things out there, but little bit by little bit, we realise, don't we, that that is actually a person out there whose life is as valuable to them as my life is to me. That's a hard one to get, isn't it? I remember one author talking about the fact that it's a bit like we're in a play, each one of us is in a play. In my play, the one that I've written, I'm the main actor, and I'm in every scene. And everyone else is like supporting, I've got a few supporting actors, and they're in quite a lot of the scenes, and then lots of extras. You're extras in my play, and I'm the main actor, and I'm in every scene. But you're the main actor in your play, and I'm just an extra in your play. That's what's happening, isn't it? But that isn't the reality of the situation, you know. You're not an extra to anybody, actually, and I'm not an extra to anybody. We all feel our own lives to be utterly valuable, yeah? And this is the darkness that has to go from our eyes, isn't it? The fact that other people really do exist as people. That's one of the big challenges, isn't it, of the spiritual life. And it was ripped suddenly from, I'll call her Mary. That's a bit, it's a bit matey and a bit familiar. I don't know Mary, I've never met her, but you can't call her Oliver. So I'm going to call her Mary throughout. She won't mind. So in the woman's restroom, one compartment stood open. A woman knelt there washing something in the white bowl, and we know now that that something was an airport ashtray. Disgust argued in my stomach, and I felt in my pocket for my ticket. That is one of the great little lines of a poem, isn't it? I felt in my pocket for the ticket. It says so much, doesn't it? This is like, I've got a way out of here. I don't have to stay. And in a few hours, I'll be travelling away from this place where women earn their living by kneeling in the toilet, washing airport ashtrays. Let me out of here. I felt in my pocket for my ticket. How often do we do that? You know, yeah, it's okay, I can get out of here. I've got a way out, yeah. Disgust argued in my stomach. She actually felt it in her stomach. What is this? You know, wow. And then she says, strangely, a poem should always have birds in it. And there's all this stuff about kingfishers and rivers and waterfalls. And she's in an airport. What's going on? What's going on, if you know Mary Oliver's work, is that she's actually a nature poet. It's very, very unusual for her to write about people. And it's unheard of for her to write about people in an airport. It's just not her at all. All her poems usually, nearly all of them, are about being out in nature. That's what she does, yeah? So now she's making fun of herself. That's what she's doing. A poem should always have birds in it, because that's the kind of poem that I write. Kingfishers say, with their bold eyes and gaudy wings. Quite beautiful, actually, isn't it? Rivers are pleasant, and of course trees. You can tell that she's just making fun of herself here. A waterfall, or if that's not possible, a fountain rising and falling. And then she says, a person wants to stand in a happy place in a poem. Why do we read poems? Maybe she thinks to cheer ourselves up. You know, we want to read a poem and feel happy, yeah? But that's not going to happen very easily with this topic, is it? No. She goes back to the situation. Maybe what she's doing, as well as making fun of herself, she's got this ticket in her pocket and she's going away to her own life. You know, oh, birds and rivers and fountains. But she comes back. To give her credit, she comes back to the situation. When the woman turned, I could not answer her face. Yeah. That happens to us sometimes, doesn't it? We just feel so inadequate to the situation. We're standing there like dummies, you know, like, what can I do? You know, nothing you can do. I could not answer her face. Yeah. So Mary is now in a very difficult and weak position. Yeah. She's suddenly on the back foot, as we say in England. You know, she's suddenly feeling very inadequate to the situation. She cannot meet the situation. Yeah. That's quite a common situation, isn't it? What do we do with ourselves when we're inadequate to a situation? We try to hide away, we try to pretend it's not happening. But actually, it's a real learning point for us when that happens, and we can really learn so much. We could probably gain insight if we were strong enough, if we were courageous enough to be with that situation where we feel totally inadequate. You know, who is myself in this? Where am I? When the woman turned, I could not answer her face. Her beauty and her embarrassment struggled together and neither could win. So the woman kneeling on the floor is also finding this difficult as well, that Mary's sort of like, you can just imagine her gawking, can't you? Like this. And this woman looks up and sees her, and she sees her embarrassment, and she's like, what can she do? You know, she's stuck in this compartment. She can't get out of the situation. She's got no ticket in her pocket. Her beauty and her embarrassment struggled together. She's in conflict now, and neither could win. Then she smiled. Yeah? This is what breaks the deadlock. She smiled. And I smiled. Okay. So now they can relax a little bit, and now there's connection. There's actually connection. And the connection has been initiated by the woman in the toilet, kneeling on the floor. She smiled. She's broken that kind of deadlock. And she smiled, and I smiled. And now there's connection. She smiled, and I smiled. What kind of nonsense is this? Mary's asking herself. What are you doing? You know, what on earth is going on here? What kind of nonsense are you making of this situation? Everybody needs a job. She's got a job, that's her job. To her, it's what she does every day, probably. She goes back to this idea of a poem and a happy place. Yes, a person wants to stand in a happy place in a poem, but first, we must watch her as she stares down at her labour, which is dull enough. So, she's going to take us to a happy place, but we've got work to do first, just as Mary's got work to do first. We must watch her. We must allow ourselves to really look, to really see the situation and let it in. First, we must watch her as she stares down at her labour, which is dull enough. She is washing the tops of the airport ashtrays as big as hubcaps with a blue rag. Her small hands turn the metal, scrubbing and rinsing. She does not work slowly nor quickly, like a river. Her dark hair is like the wing of a bird. Yeah. Mary was first disgusted, repelled. She made sure she had a way out of that situation. She didn't know what to do. She didn't want to do with herself. She is now, at last, that she's got a connection with the woman, she's seeing the beauty of that woman. Yeah. This is something that Sangrachta, our teacher, has told us, hasn't he? That actually, with metta, you see beauty. When you feel metta, you see beauty. So now she's able to see the beauty of this woman. Perhaps she was unable to see that before. Now she's seeing how beautiful she is, how graceful she works. Her probably dark black hair, Singapore, you know, that kind of hair, beautiful sheen. She's looking at that like the wing of a bird. So now she's seeing the beauty. And she says, I don't doubt for a moment that she loves her life. It's a funny thing to say, isn't it? I don't doubt for a moment that she loves her life. That makes me think that she did doubt for a moment that she loves her life. Otherwise, why would she say it? Yeah. She probably, before that, she couldn't imagine a woman in that situation being able to love her life. But now she's come round and she says, I don't doubt for a moment that she loves her life. Yeah. This is the thing, isn't it? We all love our own lives. Yeah. The play that we're the centre of, we love that, don't we? We love this. I love my life as it is. Yeah. And I want her to rise up from the crust and the slop and fly down to the river. She wants her to be able to fly away, as Mary's going to fly away in a few hours. She wants her to be able to fly away from this dreadful situation. She wants her to fly down to the river. And then she says, this probably won't happen. And then she says, but maybe it will. Maybe it will, in a different kind of way. Because then she says, if the world were only pain and logic, who would want it? Now that is one of my favourite lines in all poems. It's a great line, isn't it? If the world were only pain and logic, who would want it? There are people who want that kind of world of only pain and logic, but I'm not one of those. I don't want a world that's only pain and logic. Who would want it? And then she says, of course it isn't. She's quite clear about this. Of course, the world isn't only made up of pain and logic. Then she says, neither do I mean anything miraculous. She doesn't really mean that this woman's going to be able to fly away, literally. But only the light that can shine out of a life. The light that can shine out of a life. That's what she is now seeing in this woman, the light shining out of her life. Today I was walking around Stockholm with my girlfriend. Fabulous day, wonderful day. And you get these, seem to be always women, doesn't it, begging. They seem to be Middle Eastern women everywhere, begging in the stations and so on. And as I was coming here, I went down to the tube station, and outside there was a woman sitting there, and I thought, I'm going to give her some money, actually. I haven't given any of the money in my... I just give her some money, so I took some change out. You should have seen her. I didn't expect it. I just put some money in a paper cup, and she looked at me. And her face. And she grabbed hold of my hand, and she held it. Oh, thank you, thank you, thank you. God, I felt like giving her my whole wallet. It's just amazing. Her, just the light that shone out of her life. Remarkable. Really remarkable. The light that can shine out of the light, her life. I mean, the way she unfolded and refolded the blue cloth. That's the first poem. The second poem is by another woman called Naomi Shihab Nye. And this one's called Kindness. Who knows it? Who knows the poem Kindness by Naomi Shihab Nye? A few of you. Okay. Do you know the story behind the poem? Okay, so it's going to be something new for everyone. I'm going to read the poem, and then I'm going to read the story. Okay? The poem, Kindness. Before you know what kindness really is, you must lose things. Feel the future dissolve in a moment like salt in a weakened broth. What you held in your hand, what you counted and carefully saved, all this must go so you know how desolate the landscape can be between the regions of kindness. How you ride and ride, thinking the bus will never stop. The passengers eating maize and chicken will stare out the window forever. Before you learn the tender gravity of kindness, you must travel where the Indian in a white poncho lies dead by the side of the road. You must see how this could be you. How he too was someone who journeyed through the night with plans and the simple breath that kept him alive. Before you know kindness is the deepest thing inside, you must know sorrow is the other deepest thing. You must wake up with sorrow. You must speak to it till your voice catches the thread of all sorrows and you see the size of the cloth. Then it is only kindness that makes sense anymore. Only kindness that ties your shoes and sends you out into the day to mail letters and purchase bread. only kindness that raises its head from the crowd of the world to say, it is I you have been looking for, and then goes with you everywhere like a shadow or a friend. How many of you found that very moving? Wait till you hear the story. So you can find this story on the internet, and it's an interview. There's somebody called Kim. I don't know if Kim is a man or a woman. She asks Naomi, I'm going to refer to her as Naomi, about this poem. So Kim says, there are some pretty fierce lessons in your poem, Kindness. How did you come to write that poem? Naomi says, my husband, Michael, and I were on our honeymoon in Colombia in 1978. We knew we were in a difficult country, filled with drug smugglers, but we were both optimists and felt we would be able to make it through. We ended up being robbed on a bus in the middle of the night. They took everything we had, passports, tickets, cameras, all our money, everything. I felt in my pocket for the ticket. It's not there anymore. It was a very stark experience. An Indian on our bus was killed, and there was a feeling that we could be next. We got back on the bus, and the Indian was just left by the side of the road. We decided that Michael would have to hitchhike, even though it was very dangerous, to a larger city where he hoped he could get our traveller's checks reinstated. I was left alone in this unknown town. I had no idea how I would eat or where I would sleep for the days until he returned. I sat down in the plaza at the centre of the town. All I had left was a little paper notebook and a pencil that had been in my back pocket. Talk about travelling light. I was trembling. It was twilight. I took out my pencil. I need a little guidance here, I thought. I need to know what to do next. And the poem, Kindness, seemed to float through the air of that little town and land on my page. It was like automatic writing. I wasn't writing down concepts that I already knew and took for granted or had seen in practice. The you in the poem is really me. I felt like some element in the air was speaking to me. Before you know what kindness really is, you must lose things. Once I'd written it down, things came clearer. I knew what I could do to find something to eat, where I might go to find a place to sleep. This gift of openness and possibility overtook the sense of being stricken. The poem was a lever I felt I held on to as I found my way. There was this gang of street ragamuffins. So ragamuffins is like street urchins, street kids, who collected Coke bottles and turned them in for a few pesos so they could buy a bun to eat. I realised they knew something I needed to know. When you have nothing, where do you get a bit of food? I showed them I had nothing, no bag, no purse, no wallet, nothing, and that I needed their help. They were so gracious. They allowed me to join their group and eat a bun now and then. Once the poem was printed, it started having its own life. Now it belongs to so many people in different ways. I've always believed poems are in the air around us. If we listen in a certain way, they will find us. If we allow them into our minds and consciousness, they can help us. And then if we send them out in any way we can, then there's the possibility of them having a bigger life than any life we could have ever dreamed for them. Isn't that a remarkable story? So let's go back to the poem and have a look at it. Before you know what kindness really is, you must lose things. What a lesson that is, isn't it? I think probably you can know what kindness is before you lose things, but losing things makes it a lot easier. Yeah. And we've all lost things. We've all lost all sorts of things. We've lost our childhood. We've lost our youth. Not all of us have lost our youth, sorry. Many of us here have lost our youth. We've lost the colour of our hair. Some of you may have lost a job, a career, a home, a job. I don't know. I expect if you sat down and really thought it through, you'd realised you have lost a lot over the course of your life. But I think it's not just losing things that does the trick. It's losing things and feeling that loss. Feeling the loss is the important thing, because if we just lose things, doesn't matter, then I don't think that particularly helps you to be kinder. It's when you felt the loss that it allows you to be kinder, because then you can empathise. I remember many years ago when I was a young man, I was very intolerant of those people who had lost a lover, you know, the lover who had left them, and they were completely distraught on the floor. I was thinking, what's the matter with you? Come on, it's only a lover, get up. Until I lost a lover, and I was on the floor. And ever since then, I've been very, very empathic when somebody tells me about a love affair that's gone wrong. I've been much more kind and sympathetic to them. And that's what happens, isn't it? So, where's Ava? Did I tell the story of the little car last weekend? The little tin car, do you remember?
Yes.
I did. I won't tell that again now.
Oh, well, do it.
Shall I? You don't mind?
Yes. Never mind.
So when I was 5 years old, I was infant school, yeah. And one Christmas, we pulled the crackers, and a little tiny little tin car came out of the cracker. Do you do that here? Christmas crackers? You get these cheap little gifts in these Christmas crackers that you pull on Christmas Day, and this tiny little, very cheap red tin car came out of it, and it was mine, and I had it. And I began to love that little tin car, and I carried it with me everywhere. And then inevitably, one day, it must have fallen out of my pocket or something, and I just didn't have it. But then the next day, in assembly, do you have that at school here? Assembly is when the whole school gets together first thing in the morning, and you sing hymns. And the headmistress was standing on the stage, and she pulled out this little red car. And she said, "Does this belong to everyone?" And the whole school laughed at it. So I didn't put my hand up, and I saw her throw it in the bin. Yeah, isn't that a sad story? And that kind of explains a lot about me these days. But that was a loss, actually. You know, it wasn't a loss that my friends would have understood, but to me, it was a real loss watching this car go. And I thought, I really love that little... You know how you invest when you're a child? You invest a lot of love into your possessions. So we've all lost things like that. If you were to think, reflect on it, you'd realise you've lost a lot. And the losing of things is just bad news. But on the other hand, it can really help us to connect with others if we feel the loss, if we don't push it down. Yeah. So this poem, you know what this poem's about now. So she's talking about a particular loss, a particular time. Being on a bus in the middle of the night in Colombia and it being held up and them taking everything. Everything that they had. Feel the future dissolve like salt in a weakened broth. You know what a broth is? Broth is like a weak soup. So feel the future like salt in a weakened broth, just dissolving away. Your whole future, her honeymoon, just dissolving away. There goes my honeymoon. Just gone like that. Yeah. what you held in your hand, what you counted and carefully saved. You know, did you do that kind of thing? Count the money, carefully save it for holidays and for the future and so on. Can you imagine just counting carefully saved for years on end and suddenly it just goes? Because that happens sometimes to people, doesn't it? Just gone. All this must go. All this must go. So you know how desolate the landscape can be between the regions of kindness. Do you know the word desolate? Desolate is like a desert. Yeah? Nothing there. Nothing growing. It's dead. Desolate. The landscape can be between those regions of kindness. Yeah. How you ride and ride, thinking the bus will never stop. The passengers eating maize and chicken will stare out the window forever. So the journey is just going on forever, and these people completely done over, just eating, looking out the window, just imagine the situation. So now those of you who know the poem and didn't know the story, now you know what all that's about. Because it's a real mystery, isn't it? You read the poem out and you think, what's all this about? Ride and ride, thinking the bus will never stop and all that. It's a bit of a mystery, but this is what this poem's really about. Then, the next verse. Before you learn the tender gravity of kindness. What a brilliant line. Tender gravity. Those two words put together is so good. Tender, soft, gentle. There's a Pali, ancient Indian word that I love. Mudu. M-U-D-U. Mudu. I've never understood why our preceptors don't call someone Mudu. Or Mudu Chitta. Yeah, because Mudu means soft, gentle, tender. Mudu Chitta, tender-hearted. Yeah, so Mudu, tenderness, the tenderness, the softness of kindness. But gravity, gravity is the weight, the weightiness of kindness, the gravitas. The tender and the gravity together. What a brilliant coupling of two words. The tender. Before you learn the tender gravity of kindness, you must travel where the Indian and a white poncho lies dead by the side of the road. Remember, she's talking to herself, isn't she? The you is her. You must see how this could be you. Could have been her, couldn't it? But it was an Indian. You must see how this could be you. How he too was someone who journeyed through the night with plans and the simple breath that kept him alive. Again, I think this is quite wonderful. Two things, plans and the simple breath that kept him alive. So the simple breath that keeps us alive, all animals have that. Even if they don't breathe, they take something in and they give it out. So that's what life is, isn't it? Taking and giving out. So we all share that. But humans have plans, yeah? So this Indian wasn't just alive, but he had plans. He had ambitions. He was going somewhere, yeah? Cut off, just like that. And you must see how this could have been you, yeah? With plans and the simple breath that keeps us alive, yeah? So there, again, it's a poem about empathy, isn't it? It's a poem about seeing other people really are other people. They're not just human-shaped things that wander around and get in the way. They really do exist as people, just as we do. It's such a hard lesson to learn, isn't it? 7 billion of us, more than 7 billion. It's too many. It's too many to really grasp, isn't it? One or two is quite enough. Before you know kindness as the deepest thing inside, you must know sorrow as the other deepest thing. You must wake up with sorrow. You must speak to it till your voice catches the thread of all sorrows and you see the size of the cloth. So sorrow now, as well as loss. Sorrow. Before you know, if you want to be kind, then you have to experience your own sorrow, your own pain. If you cut off from your own pain and sorrow, then you can't really meet other people's pain. You cut off from yourself and you cut off from everybody. So to really empathize, to really be kind to other people, you have to start with yourself and feel whatever's going on for you. Sorrow, for instance. How are we doing for time? 8:30? Is that okay? Can you a little bit longer? So I'll just tell you a little bit about me. You've heard nearly 40 years as an order member. And until about 2-3 years ago, I think it was, every time I went on retreat, after the first 2 or 3 days, always deep sorrow. Yeah, almost like I was plunged into this well of sorrow. Didn't understand why. Plunged into this realm of pain and sorrow. And I didn't know what was going on. I just felt every time I meditated, this wrenching heart ache, really deep, quiet pain. And the first thing you do when that something happens is trying to work it out. Isn't it? What's going on? Why am I feeling sorrow? And you try to analyse it and talk to your friends about it. And they have various ideas. Then you start thinking back what happened in the past. You guess, don't you? Start guessing, oh, it's because of this, my mum, and all that kind of thing. But it's all guesswork. You don't really know. And that happened for a few years. Every time we went on retreat, it happened, and I'd be thinking, what's going on? And then I got sick of that because I could never work it out. I could never find out why. So then I stopped trying to work it out, and I just went and I felt the pain. I felt the sorrow. And I thought, okay, so I need to accept it. I need to accept the deep sorrow and grief. I don't know what it's about, but I need to accept it. But I was accepting it so that it would go away. Yeah, almost like a bargain. I'll accept you, and I'll work through, by exception, I'll work through it and come out really happy. But it didn't happen. It didn't happen. I just remained sorrowful throughout the retreat, and then the next retreat, and then the next retreat, and it just carried on. And eventually, I just thought, oh, so that's what happens. There's absolutely nothing I can do. Nothing I can do. So I just did it. I just felt the sorrow, and it's just stopped. I don't know why. It just doesn't happen anymore. I don't know what it was all about. But by just being with sorrow, I began to conceive of it as an old friend who I'd been neglecting. Yeah. So I'd go away and get on with my life, and the sorrow would go, and I'd be all happy and getting on with things and so on. Then I'd go on retreat and I'd come back. And it was just like an old friend saying, aha, you've come back then, have you? So how are you doing? And it was just, and every time I did it, it was almost like I reconnected with my deeper self. And although it was obviously painful, and I'd rather not have it, in another sense, there was something very, very beautiful about it. When I allowed myself to go into the deep well of sorrow, things were very beautiful. And, there was a kind of depth and texture to my life, which it didn't have when I wasn't feeling the sorrow. So in the end, I just thought, oh, okay. Sorrow. That seemed to be my lot, and I don't know. I still don't know to this day. I mean, I've got all sorts of ideas about it. Yeah, mum and dad didn't get on, and my dad became alcoholic and all that kind of thing. But they're just guesses, aren't they? We never really know. Yeah, what did all that came out of? Before you know kindness is the deepest thing inside, you must know sorrow is the other deepest thing. So anything like that comes to us, don't kick it aside. Don't reject it, yeah? It can be very, very useful. Useful is not the right word, but it can help you to really connect with your own life and therefore connect with other people's lives. You must wake up with sorrow. You must speak to it. You must get into a relationship with it till your voice catches the thread of all sorrows. And you see the size of the cloth. So how big is that cloth? Covers the whole world. Yeah, the cloth of sorrow covers the whole world. And when we are able to experience our own sorrow, we grab hold of that thread. And now the thread is connected to everyone else in the whole world. Now we're connected. Then, it is only kindness that makes sense anymore. Only kindness that makes sense anymore. As one gets older, I'm looking around here at some of the older people, I'm sure you will agree with me on this, that insight slowly dawns on you, doesn't it? That it's only kindness that makes sense. Yeah. It's the only thing really worthwhile in the end. All these other things, achievements, things we're trying to do, they're okay, they're good, but in the end, it's only kindness that makes sense. Yeah. Only kindness that ties your shoes and sends you out into the day to mail letters and purchase bread. Only kindness that motivates you to do anything. It's the only thing, the only motivating factor that's worth anything, kindness. Only kindness that raises its head from the crowd of the world to say, it is I you have been looking for all your life. You've been looking for shelter. You've been looking for refuge. You've been looking for someone to look after you and love you. Yeah. And I've been here all the time. Yeah. Inside you all the time. Here you are. Only kindness that raises its head from the crowd of the world to say, it is I you have been looking for, and then goes with you everywhere, like a shadow or a friend. Once you've contacted it, then goes with you everywhere. It's a brilliant couple of images, those, a shadow or a friend. Now, in hot countries, a shadow is really welcome. Yeah, I was in Brazil and Barcelona, and it was pretty hot. And walking along midday with my daughter in Barcelona, and I'd be sort of hopping around trying to find shade. You know, cross the road. Why? Shade. Cross the road. Shade. It's really welcome. But in colder countries like the UK and Stockholm, shadows aren't that welcome, are they? It's like, oh, shadow. But it's lovely, isn't it? It goes everywhere like a shadow or a friend. You want a friend. You might not want a shadow. And the shadow, perhaps, because it's a difficult friend. Yeah, sorrow, loss is a difficult friend. And you might disown it at first, but eventually, you eventually say, this is a really, really good friend of mine. So, shall I just read the whole thing out again to you? Before you know what kindness really is, you must lose things. Feel the future dissolve in a moment like salt in a weakened broth. What you held in your hand, what you counted and carefully saved, all this must go so you know how desolate the landscape can be between the regions of kindness. How you ride and ride, thinking the bus will never stop. The passengers eating maize and chicken will stare out the window forever. Before you learn the tender gravity of kindness, you must travel where the Indian in a white poncho lies dead by the side of the road. You must see how this could be you, how he too was someone who journeyed through the night with plans and the simple breath that kept him alive. Before you know kindness is the deepest thing inside, you must know sorrow as the other deepest thing. You must wake up with sorrow. You must speak to it till your voice catches the thread of all sorrows and you see the size of the cloth. Then it is only kindness that makes sense anymore. Only kindness that ties your shoes and sends you out into the day to mail letters and purchase bread. Only kindness that raises its head from the crowd of the world to say, it is I you have been looking for, and then goes with you everywhere like a shadow or a friend.
Thank you, Ratnagina. That is a Moodoo talk. It's a talk given with great care, artistry and love. It's a very, very good talk. There's a question by Mary Oliver. What are you going to do with this one wild, precious life? What are you going to do with this one wild, precious life? I thought that talk answers that question. Mm. So If you ever want to come back to Stockholm, if you're feeling inspired and you've got any more talks, you're most welcome, and we'll look after you and we'll feed you. And, no shadows in the winter, friends in the winter, shadows in the summer. So please do come again. So thank you very much, Radney Gunas. Very brilliant talk. So thank you. So that brings the evening to a conclusion. So thank you all for coming, and hope to see you here again.